By the power Jupiter has placed in my right arm, our Roman legions will destroy the Egyptian foe on this day. Artillerymen, fire the catapult. By the beard of Mars, what happened?
Well, the catapult didn't throw the rock very far, so it landed on some of our guys standing really near it.
I know that. I can see that. When I ask what happened, I mean, why didn't the catapult work?
Well, General Maxibad.
Maximus.
Maximus, the pentels on the onagers were weakened.
The who was what?
I don't know what it means. It's just what the catapult guys told me to tell you.
What weakened them?
It's rust. You see that brown stuff on the wheelie part over there?
Yes. What is that?
Rust.
Never heard of it.
I know, right? I think it's new. It started right after... Remember when we dragged the catapults through the salt marsh in Macedonia?
The day after we stopped at that cute little place for grilled octopus?
If that helps you remember, yeah. Anyway, I'm just spitballing here. Maybe something about the salt water is causing the brown stuff.
Well, I'll put an end to that. Legionnaires, I decree that henceforth from this day we shall have no more rusk.
Rust, sir.
No more rust.
But I don't think it works that way.
But I don't think it works that way.
You weren't supposed to yell that part.
Oh.
This rust thing, General, I don't think we understand it, so why not listen to these people talk about rust and corrosion? And now he keeps saying the Statue of Liberty tastes funny. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, actually, I was told by the National Park Service to stop licking the Statue of Liberty. It was a problem. It was a phase I went through. I don't do it anymore. All right, so... More so than most of our introductions, that one was actually based in history. That one sort of almost actually happened. The Roman army did have problems with rust in their catapults. And it's as good a way as any to catapult us into a conversation about rust. We are talking today to Jonathan Waldman. He is the author of Rust, The Longest War. This is a very terrific book in the history, in the tradition of John McPhee or writers who kind of take a subject that's sitting right in front of your eyes that you've become very accustomed to. Mark Kurlansky, another one of our favorite writers, does this too, and just pulls it apart and tells you about all the amazing stories behind it and also tells you that you really didn't know very much about it. So Jonathan Waldman, first of all, welcome to our show today. Terrific book.
Thanks a lot, Colin.
So let's begin with what rust is, because when you really get down to it, or when I really got down to it until I really started reading your book, I didn't understand. I couldn't have explained. I would have known to say the word oxidation, but I don't really know what that means. So is there a way, as talking to me as if I am a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old, which is probably a good ballpark, to explain what happens when something rusts?
Yeah, to the 8-year-old, maybe a 12-year-old, I'd say rust is a 4-letter word.
Okay.
To the 5-year-old
or the 8-year-old.
Yeah, the 8-year-old, I'd say that I engineers have yelled at me because I use rust to apply to all metals. I'm really referring to corrosion. But it's what happens to all but 4 of the metals in the universe. It's what happens when our most abundant element does what it does, which is basically try to combine with them by stealing electrons and latching on.
So you need, I think, 3 conditions to have rust, right?
Yeah.
And say what those 3 conditions are.
So you need oxygen. Mm-hmm. You need some metal. And you also need a pathway for electrons to migrate from one to the other. So with almost everything, guys who work on oceans, on Navy ships, are familiar with that pathway being called salt water.
Yeah. And water in general, right? But salt water in particular.
Salt water is even better, yeah.
Yeah. We know what can happen to someone if water gets on a metallic surface. We know that from one of our favorite movies.
Oh. Did that hurt?
No, it feels wonderful. I've held that axe up for ages.
Goodness, how did you ever get like this?
Well, about a year ago, I was chopping that tree when suddenly it began to rain. And right in the middle of a chop, I rusted solid. And I've been that way ever since.
Well, you're perfect now.
My neck. My neck.
That, of course, is from The Godfather. may not be scientifically accurate. Of course, that's from The Wizard of Oz. So that sort of generally tells us, not that, but what you told us before, tells us kind of chemically what rust is. But I think we also need to say what happens when a material rusts. And the main thing that happens, from what I've gleaned from your book, Jonathan Waldman, is that material weakens and becomes less trustworthy.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes some other stuff which we never wanted. I mean, unless you're the photographer I wrote about who takes beautiful pictures of rusting metals, it's not the alloy that engineers came up with and thought would suit whatever purpose they came up with.
One thing that surprised me was the long scientific trek to even understand exactly what rust is. I would have sort of thought, okay, so, I mean, it really is true that 2,000 years ago, the Roman army was noticing rust is getting to be a little bit of a problem. And I would have assumed that science would have understood it, I don't know, within, let's say, 1,000 years. But it goes into the early 20th century, and Linus Pauling and people like that are still trying to figure out what's going on here with rust.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of felt the same way instinctively. I try not to. You have to do this thing as a writer where you sort of blind yourself to current stuff, and you don't pretend, because I kind of am an idiot in most things. So you go back, and I was looking at Boyle, who was looking at rust in the 16th century, and he would do things. He'd collect metals of all, there weren't that many types available to him, but he'd collect metals and he'd soak them in vinegar and he'd pee on them and he'd put them in salt water. And he
was kind of obsessed with pee, right? Because he also tasted his own urine.
Yeah, I know. It's
a charming detail that you saw fit to share with the reading public.
Yeah, I guess I should admit there are pee and poop jokes in the book, but what are you going to do, right?
It's right up our alley. We get no complaints. You're on the right show.
So he tried to transmutate mercury into gold. He definitely thought it was possible. And his theory on sort of the science of rust was that metals had these little, he called them corpuscules, I guess little holes in them, and that somehow these holes were of the right size that salt water got in there. And he wasn't really sure what the salt water did, but it definitely messed up the metal. Not the way it works.
No. So it took a long time to really kind of understand this process. I want to say, as we're going along here, if you have questions about rust, this is certainly the most comprehensive book for the layman reader ever written about it. Tweet us, WNPRColin, @WNPRColin. Well, I want to just jump ahead a little bit, Jonathan Waldman, because I want to make sure we get all this stuff in. So we can joke all we want about rust, but rust is scary. I mean, rust creates huge problems. Some of the problems that you sketch out in the book range from, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, bridges can collapse and people can die. You sketched out one portrait of these rusty boats sitting out in some bay in California, which sort of nobody knows what to do. Well, explain that situation. That's an example of how scary, intractable, and fragile rust can make a situation.
Yeah, so the funny thing about that situation is I actually think it's more than mildly changed since I wrote about it. But I think there are still some old ships. They're from the Merchant Marine. They're bobbing in Suisun Bay, 20 miles northeast of San Francisco. And as they rust, they're leaching all these heavy metals and paints into the bay, and they're damaging the bay. And the stewards of the boats were being fined something like $25,000 a day for not dealing with the boats, but the guys in charge, the idea was you could tow them out to sea and scuttle them, or you could tow them out to Texas to be dismantled and, you know, melted into metal and turned into something else. But they weren't sure the ships could survive the voyage, and it's illegal to take these things and you know, sink them at sea. So they sat there doing what nature was already doing to them, which is crumbling to bits. And meanwhile, California was sort of stuck in this corrosion pickle of like, we're paying one arm to the other arm to suffer nothing anybody wants.
One of the great things about this book, and the book once again is called Rust, The Longest War by Jonathan Waldman, are the stories that you tell. And one of the things you're really interested in is, first of all, the history of the people who tried to understand the science of rust and what to do about it, and then also the present-day people, these kind of warriors against rust. And we'll come to them in a second. But this book has such a collection of terrific stories, many of them quite funny, some of them quite alarming, that we'd be here all day. Or I'll put it another way. You can tell a lot of them on this show and still not wreck the book for people. people who should then run out and buy it. So I don't know if you have a particular favorite, but you seem, as we look back in history, to have been especially attracted to a guy named Harry Brearley. And maybe you can just give us kind of a thumbnail or your favorite parts of his story. I want to preface this by saying that a theme that runs through a lot of these stories and a lot of these people are that they tend to be the Rodney Dangerfields of their field, right? They kind of don't get a lot of respect. It seems to almost attract a kind of person who's used to not getting a lot of respect. And these are often people with a very important story to tell, and that story is falling on unhearing ears. But give us a little portrait. Give us your favorite stories about Harry Brearley.
Well, so it's true. I forget the Yiddish word, but there's a word I'm sure my parents would have told me that, you know, a sort of stubborn, do-it-your-own-way kind of guy. And Harry Brearley was very much that guy. Grew up really poor in Sheffield, the capital of metallurgy and definitely steelmaking in England. And never liked school, sort of got assigned menial tasks by his parents. They didn't really expect much of him. But he was just obsessed with industry and making things. And I love that as a kid, he would take the long way to school so he could stop by factories and peek in the windows. And he figured out pretty young that if he brought them some food or offered to get them their lunch, you know, the guys in steel plants would say, yeah, sure, if you get me my lunch, you know, you can hang out here. So he'd go to the steelworks and he'd sit on these piles of coal and just watch them make metal and hammer it and iron it and forge it and, you know, pound until sparks are flying everywhere. And I guess I like that because I bet as a kid I wished I could have done that. you know, I went to a public school outside of Washington, D.C., where, you know, you take AP courses, not as a little kid, but later, you know, when you're sitting in a class at a desk, and I get the impression that a guy like Harry Brearley was not a big fan of desks. Even when he rose up in a steel plant and became the manager, he didn't really stay much at the desk. He would always be down in the steelworks doing stuff with the guys, and they weren't really sure, are you a manager or a steel worker? But that's because he was just in love with metal. And I don't know, maybe that's a side note, but I think I don't want to say I fell in love with metal, but I definitely was sort of romanced with metal as I wrote this book. And as a writer, you spend so much time in front of a computer screen that there were many days where I said, today is not a writing day. Today is a day where I'm going to be making stuff. And, you know, I've got a grinder and I'm making furniture here and there. And I'm not forging metal, but I'm definitely messing around with tools and metal. So
Harry Brearley, and I think one point you make also is that he was at least sort of arguably the foremost and most important chemist of his moment, except that he'd never taken, I think, even one chemistry class, that this was all sort of, you know, just sort of who he was. So let's talk about what his contribution is. I think one of the things you say in the book is, you know, at the Harry Brearley moment, the idea of that rust was kind of like death and taxes, right? It was a certainty. It was an inevitability. And steel in particular was going to rust. So what did Harry Brearley do?
Well, one of the things he'd always been told to do, you know, back, we don't remember this. I don't know if we've heard stories from our grandparents, but when you washed the dishes, you then dried them immediately and put them away. If you didn't, they would rust. So he's messing with different alloys I forget if it was 1912, 1913. He mixed together a new alloy with a bunch of chromium in it, and he just left it sitting there. And he came back the next day and said, "Wow, look at this stuff! It doesn't stain." And by stain, he meant rust. And he started showing it around. He said, "This would be marvelous." Basically, his first idea was, "This is perfect for cutlery," because he, as a kid, he'd been told to deal with the cutlery and make sure it didn't tarnish or rust. And nobody wanted to hear him out on it. Everyone said, "Eh, cutlery? That's not, like, who cares?" He's a pretty persistent guy, which is also why I liked him. And he found a cutler who did want to hear him out. So he made him some pieces of the metal, and that guy, he said, "This is the worst stuff ever. I can't harden it. I can't forge it. I can't cut it. I can't sharpen it. This is you're not the maker of these great new knives. You're the maker of knives that won't cut." And so he's trying to dig himself out of his hole, and in a way, he dug himself a bigger hole. But Harry Brearley, being kind of the metallurgical genius that he was, showed him how to do it. And it turns out stainless steel was indeed perfect for cutlery, among other things.
So we're talking to Jonathan Waldman. He is the author of Rust, The Longest War. So the personality of Harry Brearley, I think, manifests itself in some of the other stories that you tell. There's this whole group of people called corrosion engineers. I think a lot of these a lot of these engineers, and maybe we can talk about Dan Dunmire, who's probably the most vivid living personality in your book, feel as though they have this incredibly important story to tell, that they are sort of, you know, they're being treated like Chicken Little or something, that they really are saying the sky is falling. It's because the sky is rusting and the sky is falling. We're really going to be in a lot of trouble if we address this. And somehow or other, this is just such an unsexy, uninteresting message that we have to deal with rust more than anything else, that no one will listen to them. So, I'm stealing your words. You should tell us about Dan Dunmire.
So Dan Dunmire is our nation's corrosion czar. He's the highest ranked rust official in the country. Technically, his boss's boss reports to the president. He's not in the Pentagon, but he works for the Department of Defense through a little satellite office in Northern Virginia. And he's only been doing this work for a dozen years now. He didn't have an office for the first few because of the office, the whole thing was so poorly funded. Since then, the Government Accountability Office has estimated that he saved the government billions of dollars, but at great expense. And he makes his way through this kind of defense, I don't want to say quagmire, but the as you said, everyone says, oh, it's so not sexy, we don't want to deal with it. And when you're making missiles and you're making jets that scream at Mach 5 and battleships and destroyers, the last thing you want to talk about is rust. So the proposal came along from Congress, and all these guys in the Pentagon said, rust, we got much more important stuff to deal with that has to do with security. And none of them wanted to hear about it. So Dunmire came along, and he's a very quirky guy. He's outspoken. He's a little awkward in public, but maybe that gets him some attention, so maybe he plays it up.
He hates goats.
He does. He hates goats.
Goats are kind of a big issue in Hartford right now. So I was just, you know, it's an unrelated problem. But he hates goats and wants to kill them. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, goats have chewed away a bunch of bushes up in Hawaii near some important antennas, and the antennas, the foundations are now eroding because there's no vegetation there. So he wants to get the goats among, but he also wants to eliminate rust, or at least he wants to go from find and fix to predict and manage. But that's also not extremely sexy. So he sort of steps it up a notch, and he tells people that he's fighting the second law of thermodynamics. And at least now that sort of concedes that what he's doing is basically impossible, but worth, as he says, it's worth doing, because everything he must have said to me 100 times. He said, it's all for the warrior. Everything I do is for the warrior. And Dan's a funny guy. I write in the book that he reminds me a lot of a coach in high school who's just kind of yelling at you to go faster and sort of belittling you a little bit in the aim that you'll take it to the right place and sort of take it to heart and rise above. But he must have told me 100 times it's all for the warrior. And I'd say, Dan, I know you said that already. And he'd say, yeah, but I can't get it through enough. It's for the warrior.
Well, you know, if imagine that you're him and that I'm some uncomprehending, I don't know, congressman on the Appropriations Committee or something. And I'm saying, well, Mr. Dunmire, I understand that you're very concerned about rust. But really, in terms of America's military priorities, there are so many other things to worry about. I understand that rust gets on boats, but we can scrub it off with some steel wool and paint over it and get on with our lives. What would, aside from trying to throttle me, what would Dan Dunmire, what would he say to readjust my understanding of this?
Well, he'd say that hasn't worked. And the first time I met Dan Dunmire was actually at a Navy conference in Norfolk, Virginia, called Mega Rust, which is one of the better named conferences I've ever heard of. And I believe it is paid for by our tax dollars, but it's also for a great cause because they're trying to save billions of dollars by changing the tactics that they use to approach rust. And at that conference, I heard a number of admirals say that they were worried. So rust poses the number one threat to the U.S. Navy, more than any other country, any whatever rogue nation or something. And I heard these admirals say that we can't buy our way to, let's say they want to have 300 and change ships, big battleships, destroyers, cruisers, carriers. They said, we can't buy our way there. We cannot afford to, because we can't even keep 200 ships with what rust is doing to them. And I heard one of the admirals, who was an engineer who attended MIT, he said that we need to change the way the Navy deals with rust. We need sailors to be developing a questioning attitude, so that if they see something on the deck of a ship or down below decks, They say, is it supposed to be brown and cruddy like that? Is it supposed to squeak? You know, should the head squeak when it turns? And I didn't serve, but I did not expect to hear someone at that level say that a rigid, structured branch of the Defense Department should be developing a questioning attitude. That seemed really provocative to me.
One of the ways in which, I mean, it's one of the recurrent themes in your book is how, as we were saying, how hard it is to get people's attention about this and somehow or other make it real or sexy or interesting to them. We're going to have to take a break in just a second, but before we do, we should mention that one of the very important figures recruited by Dan Dunmire was LeVar Burton, because you've got to have Geordie LaForge explain this to people. So what is LeVar Burton's role in all this?
Well, the primary role is that Dan Dunmire is a Trekkie through and through, and he probably could have imagined no one better to take this fight and present it to the world because of his Star Trek appeal, also because he used to host Reading Rainbow, and that's educational. And he's a movie star. Mm-hmm. He's also really into STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. But I think it really comes down to the fact that Dan Dunmire, our nation's highest ranked Rust official, is at heart a Trekkie, and we talked a few times about how he went to the convention in, I want to say, 06 in Las Vegas, and he went there dressed as Captain Kirk, you know, with the full uniform and everything, and he stayed up at the Stratosphere, the giant tower about a mile north of the convention center, and our nation's highest ranked Rust official walked about a mile down Paradise Boulevard with the uniform of the Starfleet Command in public. And I thought, but yep, I know why he chose LeVar Burton.
So he's getting LeVar Burton to make these sort of educational video podcast things, right? And it almost becomes like Godfather 3, right? We even have a little transcript where LeVar Burton's trying to get out and Dan Dunmire keeps pulling him back.
Yeah, so there were originally supposed to be, I think, three or four Corrosion videos, and every time Dan says, come on, these are so great, let's do five. He calls them LeVar 5, LeVar 6. So there's actually now seven. Mm-hmm. I think they just finished filming number 7. I was on the film production studio in Florida when they filmed number 5. And I overheard Dan convince LeVar to do number 6. At first he resisted, and then he, like everybody around Dan, he yielded. He said, you're so persuasive. Sure, I'll do it. It's all for a good cause. And probably the most important part of the conversation is where LeVar said, you know, is this working or is this having any effect? And Dan said, of course it is. Like, this is making waves in the Defense Department. A lot of sailors and a lot of soldiers are seeing these videos and realizing that this is an issue to keep in the back of their heads. And it's something like $20 billion a year to our defense system. So if that's what it takes, you know, getting some guys to watch a little video. And if what gets him to watch is a famous guy who we know from Star Trek, more power to him.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're with Jonathan Waldman. He is the author of Rust, The Longest War. At the end of the show today, you're going to meet an artist who works in Rust. Rust is horrible and terrible and dangerous and deadly, but it's also kind of beautiful.
I'm going to break my rusty cage.
Well, all those delicious things they make on the food schmooze, sooner or later they have to open a can. And that brings us to another thing we want to talk to Jonathan Waldman about. He's the author of Rust, The Longest War. I cannot emphasize how entertaining this book is. I mean, that's the whole point, is that Rust doesn't really jump out at you as this really fun thing to know more about, but it really is a fun thing to know more about. So Jonathan Waldman, earlier in the show, we talked about the conditions that must exist for Rust to happen. And obviously Rust, anywhere in the proximity of canned goods, not such a great thing. But a lot of those conditions do exist. I mean, we want to put our food in cans, but I mean, at one point you're describing Coca-Cola, Coke, which I think you describe as a corrosion nightmare, one of many rejected advertising slogans for Coca-Cola. But I mean, talk a little bit about just the struggle to find a way to have a can that wouldn't rust.
Sure.
So I mean, you've been to can school. We should say that.
I actually got my diploma from can school just a week ago.
So tell us about can school.
So I happen to live 10 miles up the road from the world's largest can manufacturer. And we go through, the world goes through like 200 billion cans a year, which is enough to make, let's say, 4 dozen towers to the moon. And that's every year. And I thought it was a good idea to look into how we keep cans from corroding. And I sort of had that feeling confirmed when on the first day of can school, which is organized by the Ball Corporation. You probably know them through jars. On the first day of can school, I heard cans described as a time bomb. And I thought, yep, that's why. So the best example, Coke is pretty good, but Mountain Dew is actually even more corrosive. And there's a somewhat notorious case in which a guy in St. Louis, who just happened to have the last name Ball, but no relation to the Ball Corporation, opened up a can and said he found a mouse. And a lot of guys probably make this claim hoping to get a good settlement from a very, you know, a Fortune 500 company. And so Mountain Dew, which is owned by Pepsi, Pepsi said, well, send us the can, send us the Mountain Dew, send us the mouse, we'll evaluate it. And so off this went to a veterinary pathologist in Salt Lake City, and he evaluated the mouse and figured out, based on some of the features of the mouse, that the mouse was at no more than a week or two old. It just didn't have cells developed in its lungs. It didn't have toes or whatever, you know, different parts that mice develop as they grow. But the can had a date on it. The can had been manufactured and closed 74 days earlier. So Mountain Dew publicly said, there's no way that you found this mouse in our can of, in our product, because our product would have corroded it away to a jelly-like substance after 74 days. So there's actually, you can look up online, there's a haiku about this jelly-like substance, and I don't have it off the top of my head. But it's a great example of Pepsi's defense was almost just like atrociously gross, of like that's how much like a battery acid this stuff you're drinking is that it would just destroy anything you put in it. And I like these weird stories. So I found a law review article that goes into detail about all the various things that have been found in beverages over the year. And if a mouse sounds gross, when people have found them, they often describe them as a rat with the hair sucked off or, quote, blood vessels of unknown origin. And yeah, you feel for someone who starts drinking blood vessels of unknown origin.
This obviously, so you got to find something that can contain something that's that caustic. So how did they do it?
So we call them aluminum cans, but aluminum is good and rigid and is what allows us to stack pallets on top of pallets and cans on top of other cans and fridges and pantries and coolers. But really it's a plastic can, and it's just, we call it aluminum or we call it just a can because that's sort of a shortening, but of course, it's not just a metal can. The can would corrode. You know, if you just put Coke in an aluminum can, it would corrode in 3 days. So all the cans for foods and beverages are lined with an epoxy, which the industry calls an internal coating. And this is no surprise. It's sort of the same with when you drink coffee out of a cup. It's got wax on it. You can't put hot coffee in paper. It would turn to mush in about 10 seconds. So this epoxy is studied very, very carefully. And this is basically why I went to can school, to figure out how they figure out how much epoxy to use, how they figure out, and that's determined by how corrosive they don't call them beverages, they call them products, how corrosive the product is. And then they study the interaction between the product and the coating to make sure that it doesn't change the flavor of the thing that you're probably paying somewhere from 50 cents to a buck to drink. So I learned a lot about this at can school. I learned that this coating is it's the very same stuff that's sort of at the heart of the baby bottle BPA, fracas or controversy. 80% of these coatings are BPA. It's a material that makes plastic plastic. And it's what keeps Mountain Dew from attacking your can. It's what keeps tomato sauce. There's something like 15,000 different coatings all fine-tuned for all the foods and beverages out there. And one of my favorite factoids I learned in this is that you're going to make Collins energy drink and you've decided this is way better than radio. You're going to start selling energy drinks. So you call up Ball and you say, I'm going to make a run of whatever, 10 million gallons. So I'm going to need like 100 million cans. Ball says, that's great. Send us some of your energy drink. We'll test it to see how much coating to put in and if we can even put it in a can. And 1 in 7 times, Ball will say, your energy drink is too corrosive. You need to change the formula. here are some ways how you can cut down on the dyes or the salts or the caffeine. But as it stands right now, your beverage needs to go in some other container. It cannot go in a can. And that just astonished me.
Yeah. I would like to emphasize, Jonathan, that when I do put out my energy drink, it will contain only blood vessels of known origin. If you encounter a blood vessel in it, I will be able to tell you whose blood vessel it is. So did this make you, when you were all done, and we should say you almost got kicked out of Cannes School for being almost too attentive a student, which is unusual in life. But did this make you, did it change your behavior? Are you less likely to go get yourself a delicious beverage or open up a can of crushed red pack tomatoes because of what you know?
Yeah, it has. So the most surprising thing that, there's a couple fine points about this. One is that it turns out that exposure to BPA is a little bit like exposure to DDT, and that it affects people before puberty much more greatly than afterwards. And also, it seems to be much more potentially hazardous to women than to men. Because I will never be breastfeeding a child, it doesn't quite seem the hazard to me. But again, these are just known hazards. I mean, what we're learning about BPA is that the tolerance that we allow, that the FDA allows, may be off by 1 to 8 orders of magnitude. Not like half off or a quarter off, but like, you know, a billion times off. And I talked to a guy who works at the Coatings Research Institute. Like I said, there's 15,000 coatings and a lot of experience and technique goes into making them. So I talked to a guy who has patents on these coatings, and he said, I know what goes into them. I know what can go wrong. I won't drink out of a can because of it. He said, I'm terrified. Yeah, I probably jumped back from my phone. I said, you know, I'm writing this down, right? It's for a book. And he said, I know. And so we went on to talk about whether the Surgeon General's warning should change. Right now it says pregnant women should not drink alcoholic beverages during pregnancy. And we were talking about, and he said he'd get behind it, but the Surgeon General would have to propose it. He said he thinks that warning should be changed to women should not drink canned beverages.
Hmm. We've got a call. This is, we're switching gears a little bit, but we have to. The hour is going very fast. There's so many terrific things from Jonathan's book that it's moving much faster, our time, than Rust. So here's Tim in Fairfield. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I was curious for your guest in your research and travels. I recall especially during the 70s, there was a big push for the steel called Corten or Corten steel,
mm-hmm.
and that it was to replace all the guardrails and bridges and many other applications. But then we don't see it anymore. Do you just from like a hands-on, do you know what happened?
Yeah. Good question. So Corten steel is the stuff that sort of works like stainless steel, except instead of staying shiny on the outside, it forms a protective layer of rust, and that sort of guards against the inner layers successively rusting away. And I think the Barclays Center in Brooklyn is made of it. The U.S. Steel Tower is very famously made of it in Pittsburgh. And I talked to a guy who worked as a window washer on the top floors of that building, and it was very embarrassing for U.S. Steel because that tower – because it was built in a wetter environment than perhaps it was meant for. It stained the sidewalks kind of this rusty red brown and five blocks in all directions. And U.S. Steel had to pay a lot of money to clean up the sidewalks. And it was sort of an insult to their new fancy stuff. And of course, Alcoa making aluminum is just across the river, and they didn't stain the sidewalks any color. So it turns out that Corten is really useful in some environments. It's not especially as good as it's advertised in others. And it's also more expensive than a lot of other steels. A lot of people ask me, you know, should we just switch to stainless steel and use that for everything? But we can't afford to. And that in stainless steel isn't nearly as tough or ductile as other metals, so it's not the right thing. And Corten isn't always the right thing. But you do see it. There's a building on Cornell's campus. I think it's the psychology building, and students call it Old Rusty.
Well, I mean, this sort of hooks into another theme in the book, which is, I mean, we talk about rust as being as certain as death and taxes, but it really isn't. And there are things that you can do. And one of the things you talk about is galvanizing, right? And that in Italy, and in Europe in general, they galvanize a lot more metal than we do here. Explain what that means and what the implications are.
Yeah, so galvanizing, it's funny. We've known about galvanizing almost longer than we've known about the science of rust. Galvanizing is pretty simple. You take steel and you dip it in a big bath of molten zinc. I think the baths in this country at the various galvanizing plants are something like 50 or 60 feet long. So if you've got even a beam 100 feet long, you can dip in half of one end and half the other end. And it works because zinc, it's a weaker metal in that it's more electronegative or less noble than iron. And so it sort of sacrifices itself. And that's one of the ways rust works, is if you put two metals in contact, the weaker one is the one that corrodes, which is why a lot of people stick anodes on boats. They're basically big blocks of zinc that you strap on there. And the American Galvanizing Association has all these studies that show that galvanizing works this much better than paint at much less cost, and over the lifespan of a bridge, it's even more effective. And they say they're taking on the paint army, because in this country, for whatever reason, we love bright colors. We love the look of paint. The paint industry might have more lobbying. Who knows? But we seem sort of stuck on painting, and Europe, meanwhile, is sort of on the galvanizing program. And I suggest at the end of my book that maybe we ought to look to what they're doing, because they're a little more preservation-minded than we are.
Jonathan Wildman, I'm sure when you're at a party and you mention that you've written a book about rust, I mean, you just have lots of people gathering around you wanting to talk and more. But I'm sure one of the questions that people do ask, or the series of questions that people do ask, has to do with their cars and should they get rust proofing and all those kinds of things. And what about road salt? What's that doing? And I don't know. Do you have like a 2 or 3 point car and rust spiel that you have ready?
Yeah,
so give it to us. Give us your car rust elevator pitch.
So automobiles have gotten a great deal better since about the year 2000. I talked to the corrosion consultant who, in addition to working on car design, also made the coins in our pocket, or helped compose the alloy so that they wouldn't corrode when submitted to our finger oils. He worked on the restoration of the Statue of Liberty and ensured that it wouldn't fall over because of rust. And he told me that basically through design and much better paints that just stick better to metal, that cars since about 2000 are gonna survive as long as other, the engine does. There are still some companies that make those aftermarket cathodic protection systems that hook up to your battery, but they don't really do anything. The FTC has sued a bunch of manufacturers of those things. And they said, it sounds great and it would work in a fish tank, but unless you're driving in a fish tank, it just doesn't work. Road salt's pretty damaging. We talk about the rust belt. Road salt's pretty damaging in what I refer to as the salt belt states, which is everywhere north and east of Kansas City. Where I am in Colorado, we don't throw salt on the roads. And salt is so bad for cars because chlorine is even more reactive than oxygen. So it really gets things going corrosion-wise. But it also lets us drive our zippy cars around, on days like today. So that's my spiel. We're lucky. We're really lucky. I mean, I would have liked to live in the 1880s, but cars now are pretty cool too.
Right. As somebody who briefly owned a 1999 Kia Sportage, I can tell you that 2000 figure might actually be quite accurate as a breaking point, as it were. All right, we're talking to Jonathan Wildman. He's going to stay with us for the final segment, but we're also going to be joined in the final segment by an artist who believes that rust is beautiful.
Today's show was produced by Lydia Brown and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Sydney Lauro. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jack Haley. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff drinking rusty nails, visit our website, WNPR.org. And now, back to Colin.
But right now we're doing a show about rust. With us is Jonathan Wildman, author of Rust, The Longest War, a fascinating and very entertaining new book about the war against rust. And I mean, there's so many things here we haven't had time to cover, including I look at the future, and even there's actually a rust store in Wisconsin. Anyway, we can't tell you about all that. You just have to read the book. But we do want to talk a little bit about the aesthetics of rust. The minute that Lydia Brown, our producer, started talking about doing the show, I said, you know, I think there's more and more artists who are working in rust as either a medium or an aesthetic or both. And even before we meet Esther Solons, who's an artist doing exactly that, just a little down the road in Rhode Island, you found the same thing. You actually found a photographer who has taken, what, more than 30,000 photos of rust and its magnificent colors?
Exactly. And her stuff is absolutely stunning. She grew up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Her grandfather was a steel worker at the Bethlehem Steelworks, and she has since gone to art school. But not long before she went, she sort of just noticed the steelworks and said, I should go check it out. So she went in, and she's sort of spent the last 9 years since then sneaking back in. She's eventually gotten permission from some of the higher-ups from the company that now owns the abandoned steelworks to go in there. But it's still kind of a risky endeavor. There's all sorts of weirdos and, you know, crackheads and copper thieves who are in there. And she takes these pictures of rust, and she's shown them to old steelworkers, and they're just floored. All of them say, like, I never knew it could be this pretty. And her stuff, it's a funny word. I always say it's not just Palachian. Like, it doesn't just look like a smattering of colors. She, some of her photos look like Japanese hieroglyphics, or they look like animal skins, or they look like the aurora. They're really, really evocative, and it's a funny thing to use words to describe pictures. So check out her website, or even the end papers on my book. That's one of her images, as is the cover. But it's absolutely stunning, and she does sort of what I did. She zooms way into a thing that most of us are like, I don't know, it's brown and ugly. Why think about it twice?
And we should say that we've been using the terms rust and corrosion kind of interchangeably. That's Jonathan's fault, but he cops to it in his book. But I mean, corrosion, rust is what happens to iron. Corrosion is what happens to all metals. And corrosion can produce a real panoply of colors, right? It isn't just reddish brown nastiness.
Right, and I forget the list because, you know, most of us are familiar with aluminum and copper and iron. But if you go through the list of all the metals, you know, out there, some of them turn purple or blue or silver or whatever as they rust.
Terbium turns maroon, thallium turns blue, scandium turns pink, that kind of thing, right? I didn't memorize those things, so that's in the notes. Let's add Esther Solons to this conversation. She is a Rhode Island-based visual artist. She does, as we started to get ready for the show, Lydia and I discovered there are a lot of artists working in rust. There are websites devoted to many different artists working in rust. That might even be where we found Esther. So first of all, Esther, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you.
And so tell us about your art. Tell us about what you do with rust.
Well, I have for many years been working with materials that transform over time. So I didn't actually start out trying to work with rust. I actually was working with salt and discovered that salt had all its own properties. When you mix it with water, it crystallizes. And I was working in salt for several years when I realized that every single thing I owned had rusted, that was made of metal. So, it was a problem. Like, you know, my tools were rusty. And then I started thinking, well, okay, so they're rusting. Well, maybe instead of thinking of it as a negative thing, maybe there's some way that I can use it. So I started out with the idea of if I took iron filings and sandwiched them between two pieces of like cheesecloth and put them in salt water to see what would happen. I like the idea that what happens is that in a way rust forms its own marks. There's controlled part of it where you shape an image, but then the rusting process kind of makes the image do things that you didn't really plan for it to do. And so that's basically how I started and ended up working with rust for about 6 years.
As you, I was trying to figure out if there was, and being sort of in public radio, I'm constantly trying to extrude meaning in ways that I probably shouldn't. But looking at all this art that's Rust-based or Rust-influenced and looking at a Rust aesthetic, Esther, I find myself wondering, is there kind of a steampunk thing going on here? Or is there kind of a sense that, you know, maybe we're ecologically living in end times where stuff that is stuff starting to fall apart and we may not be able to put it back together, and climate change is kind of accelerating that process. I'm not necessarily speaking specifically of your art, but as you look at that aesthetic and the great number of artists who seem to be drawn to this medium right now, do you see anything like what I just babbled to you?
No. I don't. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you're seeing something, you know, larger than I'm seeing. I think that if you look at any material, maybe there's a change in the way that artists use materials. You know, maybe there was a time where you might have had a more conservative approach to material where people only used paint. And I think maybe what you might be seeing is people sort of looking at the common things around them and noticing them and kind of saying, wow, you know, that's beautiful.
Do you feel differently about Rust now? I mean, do you feel like Rust is kind of your friend a little bit?
I guess I do. I mean, it's amazing how many different things, you know, over the years that I used Rust, I started out using iron filings, but then I realized, oh, gee, I guess I could use steel wool. And as you and Jonathan were just talking about, I discovered also that it produces a lot of different colors, and how, whether I added salt to the water, you know, whether the water had other things in it, inadvertently that changed the colors, whether I used blocks of ice to hold it in place. All those things sort of change, you know, the way it looks.
I'm going to turn back to Jonathan for just a second here. We're kind of running out of time, but, you know, as I'm saying that stuff to Esther, I'm also thinking about the end of your book. And so it's reasonable and maybe even important to say, okay, so one way that you can look at this is that Rust really is kind of symbolic of, you know, the end to which things come, and maybe we're coming to that end faster even than we want to right now, and that it's all going to be this very rusty landscape with Mel Gibson walking around with a little cattle dog and mutants in BDSM costumes, and that's like the how everything ends. But I mean, one of the things you did at the end is sort of talk to people about the future. Is there any possibility that we could live in a post-Rust world someday?
Before I answer that, I got to jump back, because what Esther just said was so, there was one thing, you know, you're asking about extruding meaning from something, and in a way it reminds me of what Robert Boyle was doing in the 16th century. You know, look what happens when you make things rust. And even better is that some of the science today with rust is down at the corrosion lab at NASA and at Key West. They basically put metal on this big rack on the beach and watch what the various paints do and watch how these things rust. And another cute little anecdote is they're working on paints that work really well for the Navy, and the one thing they don't want is paints that turn pink.
Right, yeah.
The Navy doesn't go for that. So at the end of the book, I go... My take is sort of that it's so easy to think of a technological solution, but I guess I'm with Dan Dunmire in this, that changing the way we think about Rust is a cultural thing, and as he said, you can't prevent it, but you can slow it down, you can predict and manage. A Rust-free world is an impossible dream. It's a nice dream, but when it comes down to it, in whatever billion years, when people land on the planet, you know, from outer space and say, what did we have here? They'll find rocks. They're not going to find metal things. They're not going to find the Statue of Liberty, but they'll find the granite foundation beneath it. They'll find the, you know, the pyramids in Egypt, but not say the Alaska pipeline.
Right. Well, if they're from Mars, they better not be talking smack to us about our rust, because their planet is totally rusty. All right. Well, we have to stop there. And Jonathan Waldman and Esther Solons, thanks so much. We'll have links at WNPR.org to all the things we talked about. You can see Esther Solons' art that way. And believe me, we have not nearly exhausted the entertaining anecdotes about rust that Jonathan has. It's all gone. It's all gone, gone to rust, gone to rust.
Okay, I've got a joke for you.
All right, let's hear it.
What do you get when you cross a rusty nail in a foot?
What?
Tetanus. You get tetanus, Greg.
Oh.